It's the network break. Brew a coffee and spin up a virtual donut and join us for this Packet Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Connery Murray, and with me is the most excellent Greg Farrow. Greg, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. A little bit weary. It's the end of yet another week. Although when you listen to this, it's the beginning of a week. So no doubt you're energetic and ready to go, right?
That's right. We're flagging. You're ready. But we'll try to pretend like it's the beginning of the week and soldier on. Mm-hmm. And this episode of Network Break is brought to you by IT Pro TV. You can enhance your technology aptitude. IT Pro TV is the resource to keep your IT skills up to date with engaging and informative video tutorials. And for a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account, go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. We'll tell you a little bit more about that in the middle of the show. Kicking off, we got a lot of hardware-related stories this week, and we're going to start with something that was sparked by an article that a listener submitted. Coming from Seeking Alpha, and it's talking about Infinera, and I guess its stock price was off sharply because of comments that Microsoft made at a conference for the optical networking industry. And according to the article, Microsoft, quote, prefers short-reach data center interconnects, DCI, that are directly built into Ethernet switches rather than the standalone DCI systems such as Infinera's Cloud Express. And then last week, Investor's Business Daily ran a story about a financial analyst who downgraded Arista because of Microsoft Sonic. And Sonic is that new software package that Microsoft released for running cloud networks. And the analyst wrote, quote, based on all the activity at Microsoft, it's our view that over time, all or nearly all of their switch deployments will migrate to white box hardware and Sonic. You know, so we've got comments and software releases from Microsoft that are rattling some hardware players. Microsoft, you know, used to be a market mover because of Windows, but now it seems like its influence as a data center player is growing. And what does this say to you, Greg?
It's all true and it's all false, of course. It's a complicated thing. The stock market has been very keen to see the data center interconnect market growing very strongly. In other words, enterprises are spending enormous sums to build direct links between data centers so that they can do vMotion, build big layer 2 spanning tree domains. And I've actually been a fan of that approach. You should buy dark fiber or bury your own dark fiber between two data centers 50 miles or 100 miles apart, put a DWDM on it, and you've got effectively an infinite amount of bandwidth that you can use for the rest of your, you know, for 20 years or more. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to pay rental fees, and you know where everything is, because increasingly working with carriers is harder and harder, right? You know, buying a 10 gig line from a carrier, the line goes down and the carrier sort of looks at you and goes, yeah, we'll get to it. One of these hours, we might get it back up, you know. So owning your own fiber and putting your own DWDM gear on the back of it so you can do your own stuff has been a very big trend, big money too, because the enterprise doesn't mind paying for Ferraris when a Volkswagen will do. So Infinera has been particularly one of the companies that has been a beneficiary of that. And they've been up on Wall Street, and as they're now learning, sometimes it's a mistake to do these things, saying that DCI is a boom market and their share price should run right the way to the top. And now, of course, we're seeing that companies. So you remember about 3 months ago, Arista and Infinera got together?
I don't, but I'm sure it's in the notes somewhere.
There was a partnership between Arista and Infinera where Arista was partnering with Infinera to provide DCI data center interconnect solutions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so the Ethernet LAN and the DCI would all be integrated. And this is a real differentiator from Cisco. It makes Arista quite a lot cheaper than a Cisco solution, you know, buying devices at the edge of your network to run DCI-like technologies, but you buy extra Cisco devices to run over the carrier devices, which run over DWDM. There's a lot of, you know, accumulated costs in that model. So when the DCI market suddenly got slower and people sort of said, well, you know, if we can just get a DWDM blade and slot it home to a chassis, then I actually don't need Infinera's standalone gear, which sort of takes away from the pitch they've been making.
Right.
And then, of course, Arista has been up to 30% of its revenue comes from Microsoft in the cloud. And so if Microsoft is suddenly going to start running its own operating system, and, of course, a big part of Arista's push to the market has been, we've got this fantastic operating system, you should totally use it and buy it. And that story doesn't seem to be holding up. If Microsoft can write its own operating system and it's going to use it, then does Arista's story come unstuck?
Yeah, it was interesting in this Investor's Business Daily article, apparently how exposed Arista is to Microsoft moving away from Arista.
Yes, and that is the big thing. So Jefferies in particular made a specific comment. I was able to read the report from Jefferies, and he's, George Notto is basically saying that Arista is heavily exposed to that. To, you know, as I said, 30% of the revenue is believed to come from Microsoft. So if Microsoft suddenly walks away from Arista's operating system,
that's tough for Arista.
Yeah, and it's hardware too, right? And keep in mind that a lot of the revenue for these vendors comes from not only the hardware sale, but software maintenance contracts year on year. Mm-hmm. So if you start to lose control of the customer in terms of they go elsewhere for operating systems, then your long-term revenue is going to be impacted, and that's what is affecting the share price.
Okay.
I think it's interesting that Sonic is many, many things, and, you know, I'm quite excited about Sonic for several reasons, because it doesn't rely on the Broadcom silicon. It runs on anybody's silicon. There are stories suggesting that Microsoft Sonic is actually running on Arista chassis in some cases in production, mm-hmm. which means, you know, it generally does run on anybody's hardware. And so that opens the door for Cavium and other people. So you can actually generally multi-source your hardware. You're not stuck with buying it from, you know, vendors who are using Broadcom silicon, which is great for companies like Dell and, you know, Juniper and HP, who don't want to be stuck buying, you know, like with a supplier like Intel, who determines the future of the x86 platform and extracts all the profits because they control the CPU platform. Right.
So this brings some competition to the network hardware market, because it's not just Broadcom who's going to own the business anymore.
This is what we hope for. It hasn't brought any competition yet. Broadcom is the dominant dominant ASIC maker for silicon.
Yep.
This doesn't threaten it. Like Microsoft Sonic is not suddenly, you know, displacing Cisco's Nexus platform, for example, which runs all Broadcom silicon. You know, the Nexus 9000, Nexus 3000 type stuff. Mm-hmm. It doesn't replace that, and the market's still following, you know, and of course Juniper's using those Broadcom. Everybody's using those Broadcom. So
sure,
not a big deal, but it's a chance for us to get away and have multiple CPUs, multiple switching ASICs. The CPUs and switches will always be x86, I suspect. It's possible that they might go to ARM, because ARM is a low-powered, low-cost, and we could do some optimization in the ARM, but I think it'll be x86 so that we can run NFV on the switches. So x86 with gigabytes of memory, you know, and storage SSDs in there, and you can run Docker containers or VMs on the switches to do network monitoring and SDN type activity, mm-hmm. is much more likely. But having an ASIC, Broadcom's ASIC is not awesome, shall we say. It's very competent. It's a you know, very well done. It's not bad, but there are other people out there doing much more interesting silicon things. And of course, for Broadcom, the switching silicon isn't actually its core business. It's just a thing. You know, it's just another business unit in a portfolio of products. So it's not motivated to improve itself and deliver the best features to its customers.
Right. So this Sonic and other efforts like SAI, Software Abstraction Interface, give an opportunity to folks like Mellanox or Cavium to maybe get a toehold into big data centers, because folks like Microsoft and Facebook and so on are really pushing for a more open environment where they can, you know, sort of custom build and custom assemble their hardware and software platforms.
It's about multiple points of supply.
Right.
Okay. So one of the mistakes that enterprise IT makes across the board is this, oh, we don't want to have lots of vendors. We just want to have less vendors because that'll make it easier to buy things. But what you're also doing when you reduce your number of suppliers is that you are removing competitive pressure. So the vendors who you choose, you know, your preferred supplier agreements, also means that they're not under pressure to give you the best price. And nor are they under pressure to give you the best service, because you're not about to leave,
right,
if you know what I'm saying.
Yep.
What Microsoft's doing here is saying, well, we wrote our own operating system so that we can put pressure on the hardware suppliers to give us the best deal. And today that might be, you know, the edge core switch running a Cavium. And next week it might be, you know, in 2 years' time when we build the next data center, we might want to use Microsoft Sonic, but we want to use the next generation Broadcom chipset, whatever that might be,
right,
because that's the best chip on the market today.
Yeah.
And so having multiple suppliers is what they need. And now, especially when you're starting to design your own switches, you're building your own operating system, you don't want to be stuck buying CPU, you know, the ASICs from just one company. You want to have multiple sources of supply if you've already done the investment yourself.
Right.
But equally, the same applies to the enterprise. You don't want to be stuck with a single supplier on these things. You want to have multiple suppliers so that you can sustain, you know, get the best pricing and the best service from your vendors. Being a single vendor supplier is not a good idea generally.
Right. All right. Well, that's just the first story. Let's keep moving on here. I had mentioned Whitebox earlier, and that touches on news that Cumulus Networks is announcing. Its founder, J.R. Rivers, he was also CEO. He's stepping down from that role, and he's going to take a CTO position. And Josh Leslie, who was previously vice president of sales, is going to step in as CEO. And to me, this is a smart move. I think technical founders don't always make the best company leaders. And, you know, I think it's a sign of maturity for a founder to actually, you know, step out of that role and let someone who may have more appropriate set of business and sales acumen step up.
Yes. So JR has always been a technologist. I've met him several times. He's very passionate about his technology. And I've kind of wondered, was he the right person to be the CEO? He's done a great job, of course. There's no reason to think that he hasn't. But I think he will be better suited to a CTO role, focusing on the technology and then letting somebody else run the business as it grows.
Right.
Cumulus seems to be quite well established. And they were one of the first companies to get this idea of the software operating system doesn't need to be bound to the hardware. And now that we've seen everybody's writing their own operating systems for switches, you know, LinkedIn, Facebook, Google, Amazon, just seems like every week there's somebody else announcing, we've built our own version of Linux to run switching. That validates their business model, but also means there's a lot of competitors to their product. And it'll be interesting to see where they end up.
It's pretty amazing. They've only been around a few years, and the market acceleration toward their way of thinking has happened pretty quickly. You know, all this pressure coming from bigger players like the Facebooks and Amazons and Googles of the world, but you know, they're not just the outlier anymore.
Yeah, very much so. And where do they go from here? Where does Cumulus go if they stop being supplying their operating systems to cloud companies, which is where they had a boom market in the early days? Cloud companies, especially mid-sized cloud companies who wanted the flexibility of white box, the pricing flexibility, mm-hmm. and the creative flexibility, that is the ability to stop using legacy protocols or to write their own APIs to do stuff, then that's been very valuable for them. So where does Cumulus go if those cloud companies can just go and get Microsoft Sonic and they start competing with free versus the licensed version? Does that mean Cumulus moves more towards the enterprise space and starts bringing in features that the enterprise want, and you know, with the protocols like spanning trees and LACP and you know, those types of things, so that they can attach to that market now that they're just maturing and that the enterprise market wants that?
I mean, I think they have to, because if you're a big enough shop, you can, you know, sort of put together your own OS, whether it's Sonic, which sounds like it needs a little bit of wrangling to put together. It's not just a package you download and start running, you know, or the other free network operating systems that are coming out from folks like HPE. So Cumulus, what it needs to do is start adding features and start adding support, you know, services, kind of a Red Hat model. And I think they do need to go after the enterprise market. They can't just be a cloud provider anymore, because the big cloud companies can really, they have so many options to do it for themselves that Cumulus, what's their value proposition?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. That's, you know, where do they go if the cloud market can just Microsoft Sonic, OpenSwitch, HP's OpenSwitch, which is an open source product, which has got a lot of momentum. Dell's got its OS 10 project.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just open source. These are big vendors throwing money into it. And of course, Cisco's operating systems, you know, you can't ignore Cisco in any of these discussions. They are increasingly Linux too. They're not open Linux. They're still very closed. You're not allowed to play with them and do real, like, take it in any direction that you want. Cisco wants to lock it down and keep it in a particular box. Perfectly fine choice, but you know, it's all Linux. So where's the value if you're producing another Linux operating system?
That's right. Yeah, some work for the new CEO.
Yeah.
So sticking with hardware, you found this story. Apple apparently wants to start designing its own servers, in part because of suspicions that maybe hardware is being intercepted before it actually gets delivered to them.
I'm not convinced about this. So there's an article on theinformation.com. It's a pay site, so unfortunately I can't link you directly to the article. But there was a number of websites, one of which was ARS Technica, which linked, summarized the article that was listed on the information. So I can only give you secondhand perspectives. I suspect that Apple was already designing its own servers. After all, Amazon, Google, Facebook, etc. are doing exactly the same thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Claiming that they're doing it because of security doesn't seem to ring true to me. They're probably doing it anyway.
So the issue that these articles are bringing up is that Apple was suspicious that somewhere along the supply chain, its servers were being intercepted and hardware functions or modules are being added that they hadn't requested, and they don't know what's going on. Mm. And so they're just concerned that, you know, maybe there's manipulation going on by a state actor or something that has them concerned. Yeah.
It was, you know, what was it, 4 to 6 weeks ago, I said supply chain integrity is going to be a big issue in the years ahead.
Absolutely.
How do you know that your box wasn't fiddled with, you know, manufacturer in the supply chain, in the warehouse, on your dock, you know, after the box was installed? Has somebody inside your company been compromised and, you know, well, are they installing a BIOS in there that allows for exfiltration of data or, you know, some form of theft?
Exactly. And it was, we're seeing Apple's fight with the U.S. government. You know, of course, the suspicion is immediately, well, this is the NSA intercepting boxes and adding their own hardware. But you've also got a giant nation state in China that has a vested interest in being able to see what's going on with products and services being used. So, and of course, a lot of these suppliers are in China. So potential supply chain integrity questions all the way through, which makes me wonder, like, is having their own design really going to address the security issue? Because unless they have control over the whole production line, how is the design, you know, knowing it's their own design going to help unless they sort of rip open every box and double check it?
Well, this is what I said, is I think we're going to be entering an era where you can do something to validate that your supply chain is or that your hardware hasn't been tampered with. Mm-hmm. We don't have that today. And you're going to need to do this, not just for your x86s, but if you're buying custom hardware for routers or custom hardware for appliances, I think it's going to impact everything. And I do wonder if – imagine this, right? You go out and buy a custom appliance from Cisco, and then over here is an x86 server. You can do a hardware validation on the x86 because it's a standardized platform, mm-hmm. and there are testing tools that you can validate it with. But over here is custom hardware produced by some vendor, Cisco, Juniper, whatever. You might actually have a security situation where you say, I cannot trust the custom hardware mm-hmm. because I cannot validate that it hasn't been tampered with in the production chain.
Right.
So maybe I start using, you know, more open systems for that. I think that's a real risk for some company, you know, for vendors. And they need to start coming up with, we've built literally with hardware designs that have tamper-proof capabilities. So if somebody starts to load, you know, a malware-infested BIOS or a BIOS that has some – there needs to be some hardware design in the silicon to say there's tampering or there's some sort of, you know, process bypass or security threat has occurred.
Right. A red flag has to go up.
And so this is – Apple is probably doing this anyway. So I would think that Amazon, Google, Face, they're all doing it, right? They're all looking at the supply chain and saying, how do we make it secure? And the only way to do that, of course, is to go from the beginning to the end. But designing your own servers, they're doing that anyway. They're not just doing it because of security reasons. It's just one of the many. Mm-hmm. So I think the articles are beat up to a lesser or greater degree.
Okay. Well, we have a link to the Ars Technica article. You can go and check it out for yourself. This is another story you brought up. China, speaking of chips in China, they're really making a hard push into being a chip maker.
Yeah, this is on the Wall Street Journal, which is normally a pay site, but I have a link here which lets you bypass it for this specific article. It's very interesting in that most silicon is manufactured in Taiwan or in Japan. And, you know, we could argue a little bit. And you're talking about billions of dollars to build a silicon fabric or a silicon manufacturing plant, usually $4 to $5 billion just as starting money. And this is fascinating because it's actually being set up by the Hubei provincial government. That is, it's not a company investing this money. It's a provincial government, a region of the government. They're taking one of their towns. They're putting a couple of billion dollars on the table to build a silicon manufacturing plant so that people will start to join. So other companies will then come and join to the region and build more chip making resources.
Mm-hmm.
I just want you to contrast that to how it's done in, say, the England, in the UK or Europe or America. You know, imagine the government spending $2 billion on a silicon manufacturing plant and you know, contributing university campuses and space and resources and city planning and stuff just so that they can kick off an industry like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that?
I mean, well, we see folks trying it. Cities and states try it all the time. They want to lure manufacturing and industry in. I don't think they have quite the command economy that China does. So to some extent, it works. To some extent, it doesn't. You know, there's been lots of efforts of, you know, regions trying to sort of recreate the magic of Silicon Valley. And sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. You know, Boston has a good tech corridor. New York is trying it, you know, more on the information side than on the, you know, manufacturing side. But it doesn't always work. And just because you build it doesn't mean it will come. Although I have to say that China does seem more successful in these sort of, you know, state-directed enterprises.
Just, hi, I think we need to do more with our town. Here's $2 billion. Right? You don't normally hear the San Francisco government saying, you know, like the Californian government.
No.
Here's $2 billion. Oh, and we own it. You know? Yeah. Can you imagine that?
I can't
even see it in the UK. They're not even supporting existing businesses with that sort of finance. But I just think that, so there's two things here. One is keep in mind that China has a lot of government-owned companies like Tsinghua Uni Group and a range of those. They're actually government-owned entities. They've bought companies like Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise and the Huawei H3C business. They bought that back from HPE. You know, those types of things. You know, these companies have this huge demand for silicon. So building that silicon locally could be, you know, something that's worth doing. So making us a center of silicon excellence. But Taiwan, the other thing too here is there is a little bit of geopolitics. China does want to get Taiwan back.
Right.
And if you can disrupt Taiwan's economy, you might have a better chance. So starting up a silicon manufacturing business that could take away from Taiwan may have a long-term goal if you're thinking on a 25-year, 50-year horizon.
Yes, that's a good point. Another story you brought up, Finisar is introducing 25-gig Ethernet optics for high-speed data centers.
So Finisar is one of the three suppliers that makes all of the SFP modules in the world today. Fundamentally, there's really not that many companies that actually make them. Finisar is one of them. So the fact that they've actually introducing 25 gig Ethernet optics, and it's not just the SFP28 form factor, it's also active optical cables, means that you'll start to see greater 25 gig supply coming from the ODM. So ODMs are original device manufacturers, so companies like Cisco and Juniper, HPE, and you know all of the switch manufacturers will now have a better form of supply for 25 gig optics, laser optical, not just copper, but optical. A lot of the 25 gig is currently coax, and the shifter optical will help to push the 25 gig Ethernet along. Just a big shout out to the IEEE. Congratulations for taking this long to still not even ratify it. So I believe it's on the docket for the next meeting in March. But then somebody pointed out to me that actually there's so much on the docket, there's a good chance that they just won't get around to it. So it may not be until 2017 now. Yay them. Aren't we so lucky to have them?
That's right. All right. Well, if you're tired of chip news, we're going to move on to other stories in the second half of the show. But before we do, I want to thank our sponsor, IT Pro TV. With IT Pro TV, you gain access to the most important tools you need to prepare for your IT certification. And Greg, you have some stuff you can tell us about our sponsor.
Yeah, IT Pro TV is a training provider. Now, most of us have typically gone into the classroom. I'm not a huge fan of classroom education because the travel and getting into the situation and then wasting time in a room of people tends to be very distracting. I tend to do most of my training at home on my computer when I'm available. So plan it out 2 hours a night and, you know, a couple of hours on a Saturday and a Sunday, and you can get a hell of a lot done. And IT Pro TV has a range of streamed live and on-demand shows. They get using a Chrome browser or to your Apple TV, and you can even sit, you know, on the toilet with your device and watch a training course while you're there if you've got the internet. They've got a wide range of courses. There's a lot of Cisco stuff, and there's a lot of accessory stuff, crypto, programming content. It's all there. And you pay one monthly subscription price. There's no hassles if you want to cancel. I met the founder of the company the other night. Basically, their model is a little bit different from what you've seen otherwise. They put two people in a studio and record it live. And every day, the studios are pushing out new shows, and then they go and get edited, and then they get pushed in. So it's a very interesting model. One is a host who's like sitting there, and then there's an expert, and the host is asking the expert questions. So it's a little bit more, instead of just a head talking at you, there's a bit of backwards and forwards to help break up the tedium of these discussions. So it's pretty good.
Cool.
I want, you know, they're sponsoring us. So check out itpro.tv/networkbreak to upgrade your brain with the most popular IT certifications. Now, premium subscriptions are normally $57 a month, but we have a special offer. You can try it free for 7 days when you sign up with our code networkbreak30. That's $40 less per month or just $400 for a year. Visit itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code networkbreak30. Try it free for 7 days, and if you don't like it, thanks.
And you can save 30% off the life of your account. And that Network Break 30 is all caps, Network Break 30. Thanks, ITV Pro. So this story popped up. Cisco doing a big reorganization, shuffling 25,000 employees around.
Yeah, I love this article from Business Insider. So Julie Bort over at Business Insider has some really great sources in Cisco. And she says, resumes are flying out of Cisco like so many owls in a Harry Potter movie. Sources. And I'm thinking, actually, the confetti's never really stopped. So we had 4,000 reduction in headcount about a year ago. There's been every year, twice a year, Cisco has been had a major reorg or reduction in headcount in major and multiple efficiency drives. This one actually is much bigger than you think, in the sense that today those 25,000 employees are employed in dozens of different business units, many who actually compete with each other or replicate each other's function. What Chuck Robbins is doing here is not just shaking it up and looking for efficiencies, he's actually reorging into four new business units in the back end. So this isn't the product teams, this is in the engineering teams. So now the engineering teams will be reduced to four: networking, cloud services and platforms, security, and applications. So you will now have just this focus where there's engineering teams, and instead of having this thing where one engineering team builds the CAT 4700 and another one doing the CAT 6800 and another one doing the Nexus 7000 and yet another one, you know, and they all develop everything from the ground up, they're all replicating each other's work, we're hoping that we can start to see things become more streamlined and just have one of each. So finally, right? Finally, we're starting to see Cisco make some of the harder decisions around making itself efficient.
It's got to be tough to tackle a giant company like Cisco that does have entrenched business units, that, you know, has a business model of internal competition. That's really got to be hard.
Well, Cisco's not that big a company, right? 25,000 people is not a lot of headcount for a company with Cisco's profit margins and revenue.
I guess, but it's, you know, you've heard the expression, it's like 1,000 rowboats instead of a battleship, and try to get them all to go in the same direction. It's hard.
Yes. Well, and morale inside Cisco isn't going to get better while this happens. So Cisco expects its workforce to be 8% slimmer or 6,000 fewer people after the reorg completes.
That's hard.
So instead of focusing on producing products, I think quite a few people will be focusing on, am I going to get the boot? I think this also might signal a larger trend in that Cisco's realizing that there's not a lot of growth in the enterprise or in service provider networking. So the only time companies like these big companies do efficiency, and this is fundamental economics and business operations and business management, you only do these reorganizations if there's no profits on the table or if your business is shrinking, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's clear that enterprise and service provider networking now needs to rationalize because there's no growth in that market. The business is shrinking. Customers are turning away from Cisco at a very, not at a slow rate. I mean, Cisco's doing a great job of retaining them. But Cisco is looking at other markets for growth, specifically Internet of Things. It's moving into the cloud operating systems. We're seeing more announcements this week around Metapod and Metastack, you know, it's open stack distributions and it's container driven architecture, data center operating system stuff. Cisco doesn't expect these business units to grow, and we know the same thing. You can run your most enterprise data centers could be run on 2, 4, 6 switches tops. So if you're making money out of selling switches, there's not going to be much growth in that. And so they have to get more efficient. Also worth pointing out is the new CTO is actually a cloud background. He was one of the people who set up HP Helion. Before that, he was a cloud person. And so you could imagine that this person is going to be much more focused on software and cloud technologies than the legacy markets of routers and switches and, you know, firewalls and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Well, John Chambers always used to love to tout disruption and how industries and businesses were getting disrupted out of existence. And Cisco is obviously going through its own disruption phase. And it seems like the company is actually taking it seriously. They recognize the issue and they're trying to take steps to survive and thrive.
To some extent. I mean, one of the things that still sticks out, and the Business Insider pulls out this calls this out, which reminded me of it, is that NCEMI, or the Cisco ACI product team, is still not integrated into Cisco. That's not a good thing, I think. I think overall, you need to see ACI as part of the main Cisco product line. Otherwise, that product's going to sit out on the side and not be integrated with other things. So we're now seeing this new Cisco Enterprise DNA, this NFV initiative. That's directly competitive to ACI. Why have I got two things doing the same thing? Mm-hmm. I don't understand that. And I think that Cisco's still got some major problems here. It needs to make its decision about, is it going to be ACI or is it going to be you know, is it going to do the NCME or is it going to do its internal SDN project? And it's got to make one or the other. It can't, I don't think it can back both for very much longer.
You also pulled out a story about Intel moving away from a tick-tock chip production cycle.
So those of us who follow servers, which is a lot of people, knows that in every year, Intel produces a new CPU with, you know, technological excellence, you know, more DRAM, more whatever. And then the next year, they shrink the die size. So it goes from 20 nanometer to 14 nanometer to blah, blah, blah. And what we're seeing now, of course, is that that meant that you could go out and buy a new server every 2 to 4 years, and it would be so much faster and so much more power efficient and have so many new features that it was compelling to buy new servers and throw the old ones away as consumable items. We might see that that's going to slow down now because x86 hardware is really sort of slowing its down its pace of innovation. It's reached its peak of the current innovation cycle. And I think there'll be a lot of people out there going, oh, thank God for that, because replacing all those servers all the time is getting quite annoying. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
It'd be nice to put them in place and get some value out of them before I have to throw them away and ruin my ROI with a human resources cost to actually, you know, unbolt the servers and throw them in the bin.
Sure, not to mention all the work you have to do to strip the data, make sure they've been blanked out, and then the e-waste associated with them.
I think that we have to look at them like they're laser printers or inkjet printers. We have to treat most of our IT assets as consumables, but it'd be great to have, you know, get a bit more out of them. And ultimately, the x86 servers are as powerful as we need for most enterprise use cases. Mm-hmm. You know, once you run 100 VMs on an x86 server, there's not much more you need.
Right. What else do you
running
need
200 actually starts to bring its own problems. You know right. what I mean?
Like, yes, absolutely.
If the server goes boom, you've just lost 200 machines. Right. Ah, that's like, wow.
So, yeah, there is a point of diminishing returns.
There is, yeah.
It would be interesting to see how Intel deals with that. Switching now to software-defined WANs, we have some numbers from IDC, a forecast saying that they're estimating worldwide SD-WAN revenue is going to exceed $6 billion by 2020.
Yeah, I thought that that's a bit small.
It does seem a bit small, although the thing that does seem big in this is their compound annual growth rate. They're predicting more than 90% compound annual growth rate over that period, which to me is pretty astonishing.
Yeah, when you figure that Cisco's selling, you know, $2 billion a quarter in routers, and I can really predict that a lot of those custom routing things are just going to go away and be replaced by some form of SD-WAN technology, which does, you know, and remember that there's also an announcement today from Citrix, for example, where their appliances are not only doing SD-WAN, they're doing WAN optimization, load balancing, a whole bunch of other things, right? In a single box. So the idea of the router being just one thing is pretty much over. So if you're going to replace just routing sales in 5 years, you're looking at a $15 to $20 billion market, I would think, off the top of my head. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think maybe they're buying into the fact that folks aren't necessarily going to get rid of their routers in one shot. They want to pilot this, trial it, see how it goes, see if they can actually do without the router. I think folks are a little bit cautious to throw away what they know works. And so maybe IDC is accounting for that here.
I think, and I've said this several times, that SD-WAN offerings are highly compelling because of the money that they can save. And the customers I've spoken to who've deployed them say running traffic over the internet is better, faster, more reliable than running them over private WANs. I know that sounds counterintuitive, and those of us who've been doing it for 20 years, that just doesn't make any sense, but that is actually the experience that people are telling us.
Right.
So if that messaging starts to get out there, then yeah, I could see people saying, you know, let's get rid of those routers, even, you know, just to get rid of the maintenance cost and move to something that's got more functions in it.
So you think IDC is lowballing this?
I do. Oh yeah, substantially. By, you know, 100% easy.
Okay. Well, my thought is that how is this growth going to be distributed, that 90% compound annual growth rate? Are we finally going to see some of these, a handful of companies start to dominate, or is it going to be sort of, you know, spread more evenly around and allow some of these startups to kind of keep hanging on and hanging on as opposed to being, you know, shut down or eaten up by other companies? Because there's so many vendors out there right now in the SD-WAN space.
You know what? Back in 1998, there were so many router vendors.
Right.
Right? And there was lots and lots. And over time, there was one vendor who, you know, managed to come up with solutions that customers wanted to pay for, and customers converged on. Of course, that was Cisco, who has 60 to 80% of the market. Yet at the same time, so your logically, you would suggest that one company will dominate and everybody will, you know, and Cisco will be able to dominate this space. But yet what we're also seeing in other parts of the IT infrastructure market is that dominant players aren't winning. So right. Microsoft is losing in the Windows server space. Red Hat hasn't exactly dominated the open source space in the cloud. You might think that a company like Red Hat would continue to grow very rapidly in this market. Oracle isn't growing. EMC is shrinking rapidly, and that's what's partly what's driving it into the into Dell. NetApp is not is you know, in financial troubles of some sort or another, if you listen to the people in the storage industry. You know, HP, of course, had to split. So to say that, looking at history and in this case and saying that history repeats, and of course I'm very fond of that as a basic principle, a foundational principle, is that history always repeats itself. I think there's a lot of evidence here that things are going to be different, and that there's, you know, that there won't be a single company that's going to win.
Well, that's what I'm wondering about, because there is so much growth to go around that you could have 5, 6, 7 viable players. Right now, I think there are 18 or 19 out there, and that seems not sustainable. But I don't know that I sort of agree. I can't see us going down to sort of the 2 or 3 big players that you usually get, you know, in a mature market.
Yeah, I do believe the market going forward is going to be much more fragmented. A, because the cost of the assets is now reducing. So instead of $40,000 or $20,000 for a branch router, it could get down to $3,000 to $5,000.
Which in turn also lowers the barrier to entry for startups to have a viable product.
Yes. And if it's almost software centric using generic x86 boxes, then it becomes much lower. You know, companies like Big Switch have proven that software only startups who partner for their hardware, that they can survive quite nicely on, you know, $100 million worth of revenue, and they can't be squashed out by a dominant player.
Right.
And so I think, you know, those sorts of issues keep coming up.
And so this is probably a good time to maybe drill a little bit more into that Citrix announcement. It did release a new product. It has SD-WAN and WAN optimization in a single appliance. My own take is it's good for Citrix because, one, it helps a company differentiate with so many SD-WAN players out there. It gives them something to hang their hat on. And two, you know, they can leverage their expertise and customer base both to drive sales and fend off incursions from other players.
And, of course, Citrix is a trusted name. A lot of companies are already there. Branch networking in Citrix and VDI is sort of like all one thing.
Right.
It's not hard to imagine companies who have Citrix VDI deployed in the branch to save money in the WAN saying, I'll replace the router with a Citrix appliance. And in there, I start enhancing my VDI right at the edge of the branch network. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute sense. And I'm pretty sure that's where they're going.
Yeah. And you could have an end-to-end Citrix infrastructure, you know, VDI, you know, it's a Citrix WAN Edge, Citrix WAN Core, and then everything's just running Citrix virtual desktops internally. Well, all of a sudden, that's transformed your branch capability.
And I talked to a Citrix executive about this, and they feel like SD-WAN is going to be the real driver going forward, and WAN optimization, you know, over time is essentially going to disappear as a standalone product category and sort of get subsumed as a function rather than a standalone system.
Yes. Once you put a box there, routing inherently is not all that valuable. You know, routing was valuable 10 years ago. It should have died off 10 years ago, really, to be replaced by these sorts of appliances. But we haven't moved forward for whatever reason. Now we're in a situation where we can. This goes back to what I said about, you know, Cisco. I think Cisco knows that this market is going to change. And so they're putting their efforts into making themselves more efficient internally and then looking for growth in other markets like IoT or cloud operating systems or, you know, in a dozen different directions, it would seem.
Right.
And that's why we're seeing this market. So that I see that as confirmation that the SD-WAN is a transformational technology.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of another episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they find you?
They can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com. Of course, there's many other more podcasts at Packet Pushers, but I'm also on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook if you want to follow me there, where I push out little compacted pieces of snark on a continuous basis.
That's a continuous delivery of snark. And I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow me on Twitter if you like at @Drew_CM. This episode of Network Break was brought to you by IT Pro TV. If you're looking to get certification or just keep up your IT skills, they've got engaging, informative video tutorials, and they've got a special offer for our listeners. You can get a free 7-day trial and 30% off the life of your account if you go to itpro.tv/networkbreak and use the code NETWORKBREAK30. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, please like us on Facebook, share it with your friends, leave a recommendation on iTunes, and please check out our newsletters. We've got Human Infrastructure Magazine, which goes out bi-weekly. It's all about life in IT, and Link Propagation, which is a weekly collection of essential news links. You can find all that on packetpushers.net, and thanks for listening.